All right, we're going to continue our discussion on sorting today and hopefully talk about searching too. We left off last time, we just finished talking about the quick sort algorithm. And if you recall, we said the idea of a quick sort algorithm is that it does partitioning on the array. It starts off by dividing the array up into two partitions. A right part of the array where all of the values will be greater than or equal to some partition value that we select, and a left part of the array which contains values that's less than the partition value. Now, which is usually referred to as the pivot value. Now, here on slide 13-16, down at the bottom, is the partition function, which takes a subset of the array from start to end and a pivot value, and it partitions the array up into two partitions according to this pivot value, and it returns back the value, the index, which is the beginning of the right partition. So from the index to the end index, that part of the partition contains values that's greater than or equal to this pivot value. And from start to that returned index minus 1 is the partition of the array that contains values that's less than the pivot value. And we pointed out that in order to ensure that this partition function works correctly, we have to have at least two distinct values, and we have to choose the larger of those two values in order for that partition function to work correctly. That partition function is based on the assumption that there are at least two different values, and the pivot value is the larger of the two. We looked at this find pivot function here on the following slide, which just goes through the array until it finds two different values and picks the larger of the two. We pointed out that while that's very quick, it's not a very good choice for the pivot value, because ideally we would like to choose a pivot value which is an approximation of what's termed the median of the partition. The median value for a group of values is a value where it falls in the middle of the range, and so it would result in equal partitions. But we said there's a trade-off, that the time that it would take us to find the median would be too cost prohibitive, and that time that would be better spent actually doing the sorting and doing the partitioning. And there's a couple other ways we could do this. We could choose the middle of three different elements, the first three different elements, or we could pick some small number of the elements and sort them and choose that small number and assume that that's a relative sample of our partition. Something like that would probably give us a slightly better estimate for the partition median without requiring that much more work. And here on the following slide, 13.18 was the recursive version of quick sort, where we first try and find a pivot value from the start to the end of the array, and as long as we did find that pivot index, then we set the pivot key value, we do our partitioning by calling the partition function, and then we just call quick sort recursively on those two partitions that we just formed. And of course, that's going to branch out, and it's going to call quick sort recursively on a bunch of different partitions. Eventually, the partitions will get to be of size 1, and it will end up having those partitions will be sorted, and it'll stop the recursive calls. In the average case, this is an n log n sort. It's actually the fastest n log n sort that anyone's come up with by a constant factor. There are other n log n sorting algorithms. We have to be a little bit careful because in the worst case, this could degenerate into an n squared sort. The worst case is when the initial ordering is in the opposite order that we're trying to sort these in. In that case, we would always end up, if we were wanting to sort in ascending order from smallest to largest, but the array was in descending order, and we chose the larger of the first two, we would always end up choosing the larger value, and so we'd end up getting a right partition of size 1, and the left partition would be the rest of the array. And that would end up degenerating into an n squared sort. And we mentioned that one way around that would be to randomly mix the values up to minimize the chance of that occurring before we actually do the initial sorting. The probability, there are, in fact, with an array of size n, if we're sorting n elements, there are actually a total of n factorial permutations, n factorial ways of ordering all of the elements, one of which is the correct sorted order, one of which is the exact opposite sorted order. But even if we mix these things up randomly, the probability of hitting the worst case is not really 1 over n factorial, that we would be hitting the exact opposite ordering, because there are several other orderings which are close enough to the worst case that would still degrade it into an n squared sort. But compare that number over the over n factorial, if n is a fairly decent size, is so small that we don't really have to worry about that. And if we think that there's any chance that the there's a decent chance that these things might be in the opposite sorted order before we sort them, then we would want to mix them up first. Now, how would you randomly mix up n elements? What's a fast way of doing that? What would be a fast way? If you've got an array of n elements and you wanted to randomly mix them up, what would be a fast way of doing that? That's correct. You can do it in order n. You can do it in one pass through the array. What you would do is you would initially generate a random number from 1, or actually our array goes from 0 to n minus 1. So we would actually generate a random number from 0 to n minus 1. And then whatever random number that would be, let's say it's I, we would swap the ith element with actually the last element. We would swap it, you can do it a couple ways, but it's probably easiest to swap it with the last one. So you swap that ith element with the nth minus 1 element. And then the next time through the array of course gets incremented. Actually, it's better to just decrement the array and go backwards. And then you can just use the array loop value for your modulus for generating the random number. The next time through the loop, then you generate a random number from 0 to n minus 2. And whatever random number that is, you swap that one with the nth minus 2 one. And you just keep going down through the array that way. And that randomly mixes them up. Let's say you were writing a program where you would allow your user to sort the items in ascending or descending order. And they've asked you now to sort them in ascending order. And you know you had just previously sorted them, they'd asked you to sort them in descending order. So at that point, you should do what?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just drop the end one and the end one.
I wouldn't even bother to sort them. I wouldn't even bother to swap them. I would have a flag. That's right. I'd have a flag that tells me whether they want me to display them. It's really just display that you're talking about. If they want you to sort them in descending order, it really means they want the display that they're looking at to be in descending order, right? And if you've already got them in ascending order in your memory, there's no point in resorting them. That just means you swap your array limits to where you go backwards now and display them in the opposite order, right? There's no point. Don't ever do that in a program. If you're allowing a user to do ascending and descending sorts, you only sort one way. And then you just flip your display is all you do. However, we know that we don't want to do things recursively if we want to do them fast, right? While quick sort can easily be stated recursively, it's a little bit more tricky to state it iteratively, but it's a lot more efficient. So we'll go through the iterative statements of quick sort here on slide 13-19. Basically, to do this iteratively, we have to use a stack to store the partitioning bounds that we partition the array up in so that we store the partitions of the array that remain to be sorted. That is what the recursion does for us automatically. Because when we call it recursively with those different array bounds, it's keeping track of the partitions that remain to be sorted. So we have to do that. So we can use some stack implementation, some stack class, and our stack item or our stack element would only have to hold two integers, a low and a high index for a partition. And at the end of any given partition, when we went through a part of the array and we partitioned it up into two other partitions, we only need to stack one of the partitions because we can immediately use the other partition to start our next partitioning with. And it turns out that, of course, obviously, once we've partitioned it up, the order that we do the further partitioning really doesn't matter because all of the elements that go in that partition are in the partition. So the order that we do them in doesn't really matter. And what we'll do is it's actually more efficient to stack the larger subpartition each time. Because if you stack the larger subpartition, that means that the size of your stack gets minimized because the smaller subpartition gets further than the smaller partition, so there's less chance of it being partitioned up as much as the larger one. So we will always stack the larger partition to minimize our stack size. And the code to do this is here on slide 20. Here's the code to do this. As you can see, we've got our quick sort, we've got our array from start to end. We do some initialization setups here and some initial, the pivot value, the pivot index. The index of the partition k. We have our stack item, which is part, that's short for partition, and then we have our stack. We instantiate our stack object called subpart for our subpartition. We initially in our stack item we set parts.low equal to start, parts.high equal to end. So initially that's our partition that we have to begin with, which is the entire array. And we push that onto the stack. That primes the stack. The stack now has one element in it, and that element contains the indexes for the entire array, which is the entire partition. We prime the stack because we're going to use the stack to drive the algorithm. As long as there are partitions on the stack that have to be sorted, we'll keep the algorithm running. And so that's what we do in the while loop. While that subpart stack is not empty, then what we do is we pop off the top partition. We pop that off and we check while parts.high is greater than parts.low. While that's a valid partition. Now initially it came from the stack and we know it's valid, but you'll see why that's true in just a moment. Now we have this inner file, which as long as we've got a valid partition, now what we do is we try and find a pivot for this partition. We check to see if that's a valid pivot index. If it's not, we're done, because this partition is all, it contains equal values. Otherwise, we do our partitioning. We set our pivot key. We call the partition function, which does the partitioning on that pivot key. And it gives us back the value of k. Now remember, that k is an index such that from k to, in this case, parts.high, which is the upper partition, it has all the values that's greater than or equal to the pivot key. And from parts.low to k minus 1 is the lower partition with all the smaller values. And now we just check if k minus parts.low, if the number of elements in the lower partition is greater than parts.high minus k. If the number of elements in the lower partition is greater than the number of elements in the higher partition, we'll stack the lower partition, which is the larger of the two. Now, in order to stack that, what we'll do is we'll store the high partition. We'll temporarily store that, and we'll reset parts.high to be k minus 1. So now we've got, in parts, we have low to k minus 1 stored, correct? And we'll push that onto the stack. That pushes an element onto the stack, which is the ranges of the lower partition, which is the larger partition. So we push that, and now we're going to sort the higher partition, which is the smaller one. So in order to do that, what we do is we set parts.low to k, which is where our pivot occurred at, and we set parts.high equal to temporary bound, which was the end of the partition that we had originally saved. And that's now our new partition. Parts holds our current partition that we're getting ready to sort. So now at that point, we can go back up to our inner, while loop. We check to see if that's a valid partition. It's possible when these partitions get low enough that we might actually be setting this to a partition of size what? 1, correct? And if parts.high is not greater than parts.low, we know we don't need to sort one element, okay? So, otherwise, if the lower part is not the larger one, then we stack the upper part. Here's the code on the else that checks for that, to stack the upper part and go ahead and start partitioning up the lower part. And we also have an else statement down here. If we happen to run into a partition that's maybe two or three elements, and all of those two or three elements contain exactly equal values, then we will not find a valid pivot index. And that'll come back with a missing value. And that if statement that checks for that, in order to get out of this partition, we need to stop the inner while loop to let it know that we don't need to sort this partition. And we'll do that by just temporarily setting high equal to low. That will force the inner while loop to stop, and we'll come out to the outer while loop, and the outer while loop will check to see if the stack is not empty, and if it's not, which it's not going to be most of the time, it'll reset parts now to a previous partition that we've pushed onto the stack so that we can start partitioning up another part of the array that we've previously stored. That's the way the algorithm works. Questions? What's the value of missing? If you look back in the notes, it's a constant that I defined to negative 1.
So we know that the function won't, or the pivot won't return a value that hit a parts.low or high. So
yes, we're guaranteed that partition will either return us a value that's between parts.low and parts.high, or is negative 1. Those are the only valid values that it can, that find pivot will return to us. Okay?
Okay.
And you can also prove that partition returns you a value that's between low and high, inclusive. You can actually prove that. There are actual. They're not very interesting because they're trivial compared to mathematical proofs. But there are techniques, methodologies that's been developed for proving programs correct. We talked about that, if you remember, about the second or third class in here. But they are far too tedious to try and do to prove a 100 of 1,000 line code program to make sure that it's correct. What is being worked on in the research is automatic proof generating programs. Programs that take another program and a set of rules and proves them correct. Now, you might think that sounds like a bit of magic, but think about it. We already have a program that takes another program as its input and does things with it, and that program is called a compiler. Okay? So it's not that far-fetched. There is work being done on it, but nobody's had any real breakthroughs in the last several years. It would be great. Think about it. If we could do this, if you could code up a program, and then you could type in a bunch of logical statements about, here's all of the beginning conditions that can be assumed to be true before this program executes. And after this program executes, these things must be true. And then by using a lot of sort of logical rules that's built in, if we could feed this into another program that would take that initial list of assumptions, basically it would assume those to be axioms, and then by applying some pretty much deductive and inductive proof techniques, prove that the other things that we wanted to be true at the end were true, what would it mean if we could do that? It could find logic errors in our code source. It may not be able to find them, but it at least could tell us they exist. It could tell us whether or not a program is correct. Anyway, that's really a powerful idea, because you could then be assured that you wouldn't have to do any more testing. You could feed that in, let it work overnight. Even if it took overnight, it would be worth it. Come back the next day and go, gee, no testing, I'm done, okay? But at the moment, those things don't really exist except for some very simple systems. Have you ever studied Riemann geometry, non-Euclidean geometry? Huh? Yeah, so you know, for some limited geometries and things like that, people have done some of these automatic proof generating programs. Okay, here on slide 1321 is a graphical trace of quicksort, and you can pretty much see, here's one right at the beginning. It's sorted a bunch of the small partitions at the beginning. There's like three other partitions that remain to be sorted, as you can see. And then here's one where it's just a little bit further along, but there are about 1, 2, 3, 4 partitions that remain to be sorted. And here's another one, which I thought this last one was kind of weird. It's about half of the way done, and look at what remains. How many partitions do you think remains in that last one? Either a lot or two. I can see two, obviously, sort of from here to here and here to here. But chances are, since we started with this, it's probably a bunch of small ones. Either that or I screwed up the capture on the program when I was running it, which is possible. Okay. Minor improvements that you can make. All of the function calls, you really ought to replace those by inline code and avoid the function overhead. Sorting takes so much time that, as I said before, we're willing to sacrifice clarity of code for speed. So all of the function calls, you probably ought to rip them out. Rip out all those function calls and just put the function in place of the call. All right? So for speed, you would do that. And the current partition bounds, you ought to actually declare those things in register values. Now, there's no guarantee. You know what register variables are?
There
are C++ variables. You can prefix a C++ variable, a simple C++ variable, with the word register, and that's a key to the compiler. It's a note to the compiler telling it that you would like it to generate code where this value is held in a register in the processor. It's not actually stored out in primary memory. It's stored in a register, and that's a lot faster. That's only a suggestion to the compiler. There's no guarantee that the compiler will do that for you. But the better compilers nowadays will. And so you can do some minor improvements like that, but that still doesn't overall affect the order of the algorithm. It might save someone waiting another minute or two for the algorithm to finish on a really large sort, but that's probably all it's really going to save them. If you want to see a large sort in action and stuff, you can either code one up or you can take Excel and suck in a couple thousand or several thousand records and then tell Excel to start sorting and watch it. I mean, it's pretty quick. They built in a pretty darn fast sorting algorithm in Excel. Alright, a few other considerations here. You should never really swap objects or large structures, records. That's a no-no. That's a waste of speed. What you really should do if you have to do a lot of sorting is in your structure, wherever you're holding them at, in an array or whatever, don't store the actual objects or records. Store pointers to the actual objects or records. And then, when you're sorting them, all you're really doing, when you're swapping them, all you really need to do at that point is swap the pointers. And that's a lot, that saves you all of that memory copying. It's a trade-off, of course, because we're doing additional pointer dereferences to avoid the cost of some data copying. And you should be aware from this discussion that you want to sort of investigate your data arrangement. No one sorting algorithm works best for every type of data. And you probably want to do some analysis on your common ordering of the data in order to choose the best sorting algorithm. And remember also for quicksort, if you're going to be coding up quicksort to where you're going to include it in a program and it's going to be used to sort large amounts of data, you always should also, in that code that we just put up, when you're doing that partitioning and that stacking of the partitions, before you do that stacking, you really should have an if statement that checks the size of those two partitions. If those sizes are of a certain size, you don't want to stack them. Such as, we've mentioned this before.
N minus 1 is 1.
Obviously. N minus 1.
The other side.
You still got to sort it. Even if you don't know what the ordering is in there. The 1 you wouldn't want to stack. Obviously, if you get something of size 1, there's no point in even stacking that. That way there's no point in stacking that. But really, there's another consideration. Any partition that's less than size 16, just about, you don't want to stack. What do you want to do with it? Huh? Another sort. You want to use another sorting method, something like a selection sort or whatever, right? You want to call some selection sort function and let it sort that little partition, because quicksort takes too long to sort smaller partitions. It's slower than the n-squared sorts for small partitions. All right. There are some special cases where we can actually do better than n log n. Now you might say, wait a minute, didn't you just tell me last time you proved that you couldn't do any better than in log n? That's true, I did, but only for comparison-based sorting. There is some data that we can do non-comparison-based sorting upon. Here's the most trivial case. If we had some consecutive integers that could be mapped onto the range of 0 to n minus 1, and they were initially stored in array A, then we can sort them in one pass. If we need to sort those integers, that's stored in maybe from a get key function. Basically what we do is we go through the array A from 0 to n, we get the key value, which is an integer, we mod it by n, that gives us a value from 0 to n minus 1, and we use that as the index into a second array to store the initial value. So if you were running some club and you were assigning ID numbers to members, the simplest thing to do would be assign them an integer number. And then if you ever needed to sort them by their membership number, you could do it in linear order like this. That's a very special case of what's called bin sorting. And if that doesn't map completely to a reasonable range, then you have to use some flags, some flip bit flags to denote empty array slots. There is a more general form of bit sort shown here on slide 1324. Let's assume that we wanted to sort an array of integers where all the integer values are in the range from 0 to 99. Now, you can actually extend this idea to sort other integers which are very commonly sorted upon, which are Social Security numbers. You can extend this idea to sort data with Social Security numbers. The way this works is first we make a pass through our list, and we place them in a bin. There's only 10 bins in this case, because there's only 10 digits, only 10 different digits. We place them in a bin that matches their 2's digit. That should be their 1's digit. 2's digit? Oh, sorry, you're right. The 1's digit to start with. I'm reading out of order. All right, so the first pass through here, we take 34. Its 1's digit is 4, so we stick it in the 4 bin. The second one is 16. It's a 6th digit. We stick it in the 6th bin. And we just keep going. 76, that's a 6, so we stick it in the 6th bin. It has to be stuck at the end of the bin. These bins have to be a structure that can hold more than one value. Then we go through these bins, and we put them in a bin that corresponds to their second digit, to their 10th digit. So the 40, that goes in the 4 bin, so we put it in the 4 bin. The 80, that's an 8, so we put it in the 8 bin. Then we come down 72, that goes in the 7th bin. 83, the 8th bin. 34, the 3 bin. 16, the 1 bin. 76, the 7 bin. And you can see what happens. Now if we go down through here and read the bins, they're sorted. So you could sort a large number of records by their Social Security numbers in how many passes using this technique? So not a complex question. I should save this one for the final exam. Nine passes. Social Security numbers have 9 digits in them. Okay? You have to do 9 passes. And then you end up with everything sorted. It beats quick sort, since each pass takes order n times. So if we were sorting all of the records of students here at Virginia Tech by their Social Security number, assuming that there is about 30,000 students in here, what would be a rough estimate then of the time that it would take us to do that? 9 times 30,000, 2,700,000, I think. something like that. 270,000. So at least quick sort, but only for sorting data like this that we can stick and bin. This is actually all this is to a certain extent is sort of a extended version of quick sort, except it's called distributed partitioning. In quick sort, you can actually improve quick sort somewhat by rather than just doing two partitions each time through the array, do more than two partitions. Okay, that does make it a bit more complex. It also makes it a bit more efficient. The real key is how you choose those partitions and stuff and the median values to do the splitting. Obviously, that affects a lot of things, but you can make it quicker. It's a little bit more complex. There are algorithms for extending it. They're usually referred to as distributed partitioning sorts. Here's the code to do bin sort. You can see there's the first pass that goes through. It takes a digit, it sets its one digit equal to the data index mod 10, and it then uses an array of linked lists called bin. And it stores in bin subdigit 1, it goes to the tail. This is using our linked list class. It moves the current to the tail, and then it inserts after that. That appends it to the end each time. And then for the second pass, we would have to declare a second array of linked list objects of num bin, which would, of course, be 10 in this case. And then we go through the second time, then we go through the original bin. We start out with the zeroth bin index of 0. We go to the head. While we're still in the list, while we're not at the end of that bin, then we get the current value of that. We access that, get current data, and ask that item to give us its current value. We divide that by 10 and mod by 10 to get the 10, to get the a tens digit rather than the ones digit, and then we go to the tail of that bin and we insert this one at the end of this bin. And then once we're done with this, then we could linearize the bins, stick them back in the original array, stick them back in the original data array in order. And we can do that by just going through the second bin here. We go through the second bin, bin 2, which we're passing in. We go through each of those bins, we get the element out, and we just stick it at the end of our target array each time, and we just move through the target indexing it each time. Okay? And that linearizes it.
What's the big O of linear?
Yes, what is the big O of linearize? Good question, I know it. Anybody else? How long would it take it to linear, whatever.
It looks like an n squared, but it only runs the number of elements.
That's right. So it's not n squared, it's n. Okay, there are only n elements in there. And while it looks like, since you've got a loop inside of a loop, but we're not crossing any of those elements more than once, right? We're only processing all of the elements once. And there's only n elements, so it's of order n. Got to be careful. Remember, I told you, as a rule of thumb, when you're looking at an algorithm and you're trying to decide which of those complexity classes it fits into real quickly, if you see a loop nested inside of another loop, that's usually an indication that it's of order n squared, but not always. It depends upon the algorithm. And in this case, this algorithm, which looks n squared, is not n squared. This linearized bin function is of order n.
So, don't you need the number of digits in each number? You need that many?
You need that many, well, you don't really need that many bins, if that's what you're thinking, or that many lists, arrays of bins. You really only need two at any given time. Yeah, you just swap between the two of them, okay? After you finish putting them in one, then the next pass through, you take them from that one and put them in the other one. And then the next pass, you do it the opposite way, okay? It is a very fast technique, but you can't use it for all data. Like, for example, what if you were sorting names? What if you were sorting names? Could you do this? Could you use bin sorting on names? You could. How many bins would you have to have each time? 26. And the problem, and unfortunately, there's another problem that you'd have to deal with. Spaces, yes, you have to deal with spaces a little bit.
And how many sets of bins?
Lowercase and uppercase, you got to deal with that.
You don't need to know how many sets of bins you have.
You don't need to know how many sets of bins you have. No, that's not really a problem. Because you can always, you need 26 bins, and you got to deal with spaces on that. You might need 27. Hyphens, apostrophes, blah, blah, blah. Special cases. You got to deal with those, but there's another, and ever how many that would be, you really would only need bins, you know, two bins of ever that number to do the switching between. Difference in length, there's a problem. Everybody's name's not of the same length. Bummer, huh? Bummer. Because this basically this technique for social security numbers is you do what? You start at the first social security number, which is really the least significant digit. And you work your way towards the most significant digit, correct? Well, how do you do that for names? If you start at the end of everybody's name, you're gonna hit the end of some people before you hit the end of the other. So you gotta deal with that. That wouldn't really be that tough to deal with. How would you deal with that? Substring, no. If you got to the end of the name each time, you just put them back in the same bin by their first. In other words, if you reach sort of the end of their name, which would be the beginning character, you don't ever generate an index in front of that. Okay, but then that's a lot of extra index checking that you've got to be careful about. Huh? All right, what's your minimum length that you're going to set for some people's names? All right, so you do some extra work up front to find out what that minimum length is? You could sort of do that. Uh-huh.
I guess you have the maximum length and fill in all the shorter ones with a...
dummy value?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do that. It's not easy. It makes it fairly complicated. And in the long run, by the time you're doing it, it's probably better if you just quick sorted it. Okay? All right. We're finished with the sorting discussion. All right, let's talk about searching. There's not much here to talk about, as you can see. There's only 7 slides in the searching here. The second slide, in order to do searching, the simplest searching you can do is just sequential searching, where you start at the beginning of your list and you look at that item to see if it's the one you're looking for, and if it's not, you look at the next item, the next item, the next item, one item right after another. Well, in the worst case, the order, the element that you would always be trying to find, in its worst case, would be an element that's either not in the list or it's at the end, which means you'd have to look through all of the elements in your list. Now, if there are n elements in the list, that would mean, on the worst case, it's of order n to find it. Average case, on the average, you're going to look about halfway through the array. In order to prove that, you think about it. I mean, worst case, it would be you'd have to look through n elements. Best case, one element. Next to worst case, n minus 1. Next to best case, 2, 3. Add all those up. Average amount, it's n over 2. Okay? Now, best case, of course, would be order 1. The one that you're looking for is right at the beginning. This does sort of make the assumption that the probability of each element in our list being searched for, hunted for, is equal. Now, that's not always a valid assumption. If the list is sorted, and you're still doing sequential sort, you can stop as soon as the element is located or a larger element is located. But that really doesn't change any of the orders. The worst case is still order n, and the average case is still n over 2. Now, we're only going to be talking about internal searching here. There are external searching, which means you have to look through. You're doing index searching, B-tree searching, etc. Now, here on the next slide, quite often it'll turn out that there are cases where the elements that you're searching for, there might be a subset of the elements in the list which are hunted for and found a lot more frequently than the others. Okay? And you can take advantage of that somewhat if you know that to be the case. I mean, think about over in Kroger's, for example, where they have that great technology that amazed President Bush's father when he went in a grocery store one time and saw them scanning the UPC codes over. Why was he so amazed? Because the man probably hadn't shopped for himself in 20 years, okay? he thought that was fantastic technology. And it is, I'll agree. I laughed at when I read that. The man probably hadn't bought anything from himself in 2 decades. But if you think about it, there's a lot of items over there in stores like that, like milk and bread, that's probably scanned a lot more frequently than the others. Well, now you could order the list so that the more frequently accessed elements are at the beginning. However, that does sort of assume that the probabilities of those elements being searched for doesn't change while the program's running. There are a lot of cases where it actually changes. Take, for example, programs. When your program is running, or other programs are running, there have been some studies that have been done, and they plot out a program's memory accesses. Now, a program in a virtual memory page segmentation system, basically a program is actually broken up into a bunch of little pages. And some of the pages are held in primary memory, and some of the pages are held on RAM, on the disk. And they're only swapped in whenever they're needed. Well, ideally, they're only swapped in when they're needed. What you would really want to do, and to a certain extent then, that means that when your program is making a memory access, the operating system has to hunt to see if that page is in memory. It has to search for it. Well, there have been some studies that have been done that shows that programs will tend to stay in terms of their execution. If you plot it over time, the program's running, they'll stay in one area of their virtual memory, which means one small set of pages, for a given amount of time, and then they'll switch to some other set of pages, and they'll stay in it for a little while, and then they'll switch to another set of pages. So if the program is running over its given period of time, the pages that are getting accessed most often, the probability of them getting accessed changes over time. This is usually called the working set of the virtual pages. Now, and operating systems take advantage of this by keeping around the working set these pages where they have a high probability of being searched for before. They keep those around in memory and try not to swap those out. When they have to do a swap and bring in another page, they try and swap it out with the page that's least likely to be accessed again by doing some dynamic probability calculation. And usually that's the simplest thing that's done is on access counts. Every time a page is accessed, it bumps up a little counter for it, and it keeps them ordered. The pages that are accessed most often, they're at the beginning of the list. The pages that are accessed less frequently, they're at the end of the list. When it needs to swap a page out because it's not in RAM, it's going to swap out one of the ones that's not needed. And if you think about this, this makes perfect sense, because why do you think programs stay around one area of memory for a while and then jump and stay around another area of memory for a while? Loops. That's it. It's loops. Programs, they're in one loop for a while, which is in one area of memory, And then they jump down into another loop for a while. Okay? So, in order to do this, what we can do is we can use several schemes to do this. We could use a sequential swap scheme. Every time the element is accessed, we could move it to the start of the list if it's not within some threshold element of the beginning of the list. We could do a bubble scheme. Every time the element in our list gets accessed, if it's not at the head of the list, we swap it with the one that's in front of it. This is a nice, neat scheme because the elements that are accessed most frequently will bubble up to the beginning of the list, and then as the program or whatever changes and the probability changes and you start searching for elements that are farther down in the list, eventually they'll bubble up to the beginning and replace the others. And you can also use an access count scheme, where every time that you search for one, you can just increment a counter and keep track of how many times you search for an element. And then you can keep them ordered by their access count. Uh-huh. Not resort, reinsert each time. Okay? And you can do that pretty quick. But yes, you would have to do that. I actually myself, when I'm doing something like this, prefer that middle scheme because it's so simple and effective, the bubble scheme. Now here on slide 14.4 are some sequential search functions. The first one up there goes from 0 to 5, checks to see if the A sub I element is equal to the K value that we're searching for. If it is, it returns I, and otherwise it returns minus 1. It would actually be a little bit more efficient to code that inline. And you can also make that a little bit more efficient by taking out the if statement that's under control of the if statement and basically move that inside of your condition that stops the loop. If I is less than 5 and K is not equal to the element we're looking for, then we just increment I. And when we come out of that loop, we check. If I is less than 5, that means we found it before we got past the end of the array. And so in that case, we return I. And if that's false, we return missing. But that does two comparisons really in the loop. And that's a little bit more efficient. We can actually do a little bit better than that by searching sequentially down to 0 using 0 as our limit test. So here we've got our little for loop. While K is not equal to A sub I and I. Okay? Why does this work? We're starting at size minus 1 and we're decrementing now. Why does that work? When it's 0, this is false, and that'll stop the for loop. Okay? And then we just have to check down here at the end when we finish. That's a little bit more efficient. You can do, there's an example of, tweaking code slightly to try and get it to be a little bit more efficient. There is a little trick that you can use, though, to do it even a little bit faster, to still improve this a little bit further. It's called the sentinel method. In the sentinel method, what you do is you store the element that you're looking for in the array so that you know it'll always be there. What you do is you store it at the end of the array. Each time, you always make sure that your array, the rest of your code, always has to make sure that there's storage at the end of the array for you to always store an element, a dummy element. Now what you do, before you begin your search, at the end of the array, you store the element that you're searching for. This way, you are absolutely guaranteed you will find it, right? Because you just put it in there. So what you do now is you do your for loop that goes from 0, while K is not equal to A sub I plus plus. Now you don't need to bother to check to end the loop because you know that that statement that checks for finding the element will eventually end the loop. It has to. And then you just check when you came out of this, did you find it before you put it at the end? And if so, you return I. Otherwise, you return missing. So that's called the sentinel method. It's actually used with some other data structures, too, when you're searching. Now, sequential searching, even with probability ordering, is not very efficient. Over at Kroger, they wouldn't want to use this. I mean, over at some store like Kroger, you've got, what, maybe 10 computers, cash registers. They're really nothing more than simple computers. And as you're scanning this thing over, you're scanning that UPC code over, okay? Assuming, of course, that you have it, you know, somewhere else in the store went, T-bone steak, $18.95. Ah, pack of gum, 59 cents. Okay, I'll take it. Now, of course, I would suggest that you would do something like that. You know, you wouldn't want to take a magic marker and go to the store and change those UPC code numbers, those UPC code bars. For one thing, it's illegal. And two, that whole coding system is designed to make that very difficult to do, by the way. Okay? The people who designed that weren't exactly stupid. All right? They gave this a lot of thought before they did it. You can actually find, you can look online probably, and you can find some write-ups if you really want to know why those bars are a certain length at times and stuff and how they correspond to the letters and numbers. You can look that up. And you could possibly, you know, at a time, but if you get caught, it's illegal, and it's your tail in the swing and not mine. Not that anybody would dare think of something like that, right? Actually, I must admit, the first time this ever occurred to me was not with UPC code numbers. It was when my mother, when I was studying computers back many years ago, a couple of decades ago now for the first time, my mother used to get, and probably some of your parents did quite a few years ago perhaps, used to get her, certain of her bills, like her gas bill and electric bill, used to be on computer cards. And the computer cards had the punch codes of how much she owed. I was real tempted to go out and run another punch card and change their bill. Because it was real easy to see where the, you know, $43.95 that we owed that month was at. Oh, it's these two punches right here. Oh, let me just change this and punch another one up here, which it'll hit first, and now it'll be $13.95. People used to do that crap, okay? And the companies used to get really kicked off when they called them. If they called them. I didn't do it, but I thought about it. The problem with knowing too much at times is you're tempted to do stuff like this, but it's not worth it in the long run. Now, that's not fast enough. Over at Kroger's, that probability ordering would not be fast enough. We got to have something faster. The simplest thing would be a binary search. Now, you've already studied binary search in 1044, right? In the 1044 notes, there's binary search code in there. I know there is because I put it in there. Okay? So you know what a binary search is, correct? Anybody not know what a binary search is? All right. You all do. Nobody said no. Binary search, real simple. The elements have to be sorted. You look at the middle element. Like, for example, let's say I was to make you a bet. I'll let you write down a number from zero. Yeah, you can say. You write down a number from zero to a million. Play this game with your nieces and nephews. And you first start at 1,000. You tell them, okay, you write down a number between 1 and 1,000. You give me 10 guesses. And you have to tell me whether I'm low or high or right. And you know, I'll bet you $50 or $10 or whatever that I can get your number. And of course, after you take that money from them, then you go, I tell you what, I'll give you a good chance to get your money back. I'll let you now guess the number between 1 and 1,000,000. Okay, and I only get twice as many guesses. That's all you need, 20 guesses. Now, if you think about it, if the people over at Kroger's were using binary search, and they're probably not, because there actually are some faster searches, but they were using binary search, they've got to have a search that's pretty quick, because you're scanning that code over. What's got to happen? That code's probably got to get sent back to one of their servers. Their server's got to look that thing up in its list. It's got to find the price. and it's got to send that price back, and it's also at the same time probably got to adjust some inventory, like the number of items that's out on the floor. And all that's got to happen fast enough so that you can scan one and scan another while all these other 10 registers are doing it at the same time. Well, think about it. A binary search is probably darn fast enough. It's fast enough that they actually wanted to use it because they don't have, they've got a lot of items over there, but I'm betting they don't have a million items, okay? And a binary search, even for a million items, will only take 20 element accesses to find it. I mean, looking down at even a 1 meg array and accessing 20 locations in memory is going to happen pretty much just like that, and it's fast enough. You've got to be careful about changing the algorithm. You can slow it down if you're not careful. Here's a variation of binary searching. It's really just a generalization. If you're searching, let's say, something like a big phone book, and you're using a binary search, you would actually flip the phone book up into the middle, right? But nobody looking in a big phone book like the phone book for New York City, if you're looking up Smith, you don't start in the middle. What do? You go about two-thirds or three-fourths of the way down and you flip the thing open. And that's the idea behind interpolation searching. In binary searching, the midpoint calculation is just L plus R over 2. We can generalize that to say that that's actually the lower bound plus half of the range. It's half times R minus L. Now that formula, of course, simplifies to L plus R over 2. But interpolation replaces that one half with an estimate of where the desired element is at in the range. And and there's the formula for it. It's L, which is the base location, plus some distance times R minus L times the length. And that distance, if K is the value that we're looking for, we say K minus the smallest element in this range divided by the total size of the range, which is A sub R minus A sub L. Think about it here. Let's say we've got 30,000 records of Social Security numbers, and they're in the range from 0 to 600, whatever. If we were searching for 222, et cetera, then that would yield an initial estimate of 11,111. Zero would be the starting position. Your range now you've got 30,000 records that you're looking through, so it'd be 30,000 minus 0 to start with, and then the value that you're looking for is 22,222 minus 0, if that's the lowest Social Security number, and the ranges of Social Security numbers would be 600, whatever, minus 0.